Airplane Intel Podcast, Episode 53. This week, Dunn and I discuss some useful tips for buying an airplane, including how to research, what to look for, and how to approach the owner. Then we talk about some interesting considerations with Piper Aeros and cool mods for light jets.
Welcome to the Airplane Intel Podcast, the show for aircraft owners, pilots, and mechanics. It's our goal to save you money and make your flying safer so you can get the most out of your airplane. Featuring the pre-buy guys with over 60 years combined experience flying, maintaining, and managing all types of aircraft. We will share practical advice, strategies, and tips to help make aircraft ownership simple, safe, and cost-effective. So stay tuned.
Hello, fellow aviators and aviation enthusiasts, and welcome to another installment of the Airplane Intel Podcast. We're an aviation podcast that focuses on the ins and outs of aircraft ownership. I'm Adam, and soon we'll be joined by my co-host Don. We're pilots and mechanics working in the field to help you make safer and smarter decisions when it comes to buying and owning an airplane. Now, before we get into today's topic, I'd like to thank our newest Patreon supporters. First is Rodney, who is contributing $3 per episode, as well as Tony, who donates $1 per episode, and Abel, who is generously donating $5 per episode. So thank you so much for your generous support. Without you guys and all of our patrons, this show would not be possible. You definitely help us keep the show going by offsetting some of the production costs, but it's also great interacting with you guys on our Patreon page and other offerings for Patreon members. So thanks again, guys. We really do appreciate it. Now, today, Don and I are going to be talking about some tips when buying an airplane, specifically things you can do on your own when researching and evaluating an airplane. Now, of course, safety is our number one concern, but probably in close second is value. And much of what we're going to discuss today are defects that we've recently found that have a significant impact on the value of an airplane. So be sure to check out the show notes at airplaneintelpodcast.com to see some of the links and videos related to today's discussion. Now, before we move into today's topic, I would just like to apologize in advance for an audio mistake that I made while recording this episode with Don. Long story short, I had a stuck mic situation. I thought my mic was muted, but as I later learned during editing, it was not. So you're going to hear some background noise and some echoing that comes from Don's side, but it's really because of my stuck mic. So I do apologize for the less than perfect audio quality in this episode, and I'll definitely be more attentive going forward. Nevertheless, I think you'll find today's discussion interesting and valuable, so let's get to it right now. So Don and I are here today, and we're going to talk about a few tips that you should know when buying an airplane and some things you should be thinking about ahead of time before you make that decision to buy an airplane. So I'd like to start at the beginning, and usually the first step in the pre-buy process is to review the FAA files, and we've talked about that a number of times. Don, you want to tell a couple of stories and give a few examples of some things that we've found that were important to know for a prospective buyer in the FAA files?
Yeah, I'm kind of amazed that a lot of present airplane owners never knew about the FAA files. And we have major repairs in there, and we have work orders from repair stations, which is issuing a major repair. But it was many years ago, and they don't have to apply that to the FAA files. So we recommend that you do get the FAA files right away, because these airplanes disappear quick off the market. And then you can make a decision if you want to go ahead with this airplane. Because, to tell you the truth, half the airplanes, we find major repairs that the seller doesn't know about. You have to make a decision the next morning on what information you're going to ask the owner.
What are some things that we've learned while going through FAA files for some of the people that we work with?
Well, one thing we learned, that as soon as we do it, you got to get on the ball. You got to call that owner and tell them either you want to leave an escrow deposit, because that airplane could disappear by if you wait a couple of days. And that's been the recent cases. They haven't called the owner soon enough, and somebody else put a deposit on the plane. Well, maybe that's not so bad, because if they reject the airplane, you'll be in a better bargaining position. Now, you know, we don't want to turn the owner, the seller off by, you know, coming up with too much stuff in the beginning. But we want to let them know we know a few things. Let's say supplemental type certificates. Well, this is a big issue, especially, like, let's take an example. I'm an expert witness, and a lawyer calls me up, and he wanted to hire me. He got a citation jet down there that's going to be converted to the long-range tanks, an EcoMod, and it's been there for almost 9 months now, almost a year, and it's an abandoned airplane. Nobody will fix it. I said, yeah, they're out of business. And so if you have a supplemental type certificate, you got to have at least a copy of the official document, the cover page. If you don't have that, the mechanic, you know, this is an amendment to the type certificate, the type certificate data sheet, which is the official blueprints of the airplane. And there's all kinds of limitations in there. And so if you don't have the correct, even a copy, it should be an EFA file, but it hasn't been. Only the new mechanics really know how to check this. And they'll demand that. And if you don't have it, they're going to say, hey, those flap tracks are worn air in that Robinson Stoll kit. I'll have to take the whole kit off and restore it with original parts to its original configuration. Holy, that's a big deal. So you got to check on that. Now, some people say, well, that's in the FAA.gov/mechanics. There's a place right there where they list all the supplemental type certificates. Yeah, they do, but it doesn't give you the cover page. It just says, oh, these 100 SCCs are approved for your Cessna 182 model or whatever. And that's all it tells you. It doesn't give you the cover page. So the mechanic has to make sure that it's approved for your make and model, and sometimes right down to serial number. And that'll be on the top of the page. And a lot of times the supporting documents that prove that. And then under the airworthiness limitation section on the very bottom of the page, it might have a special inspection. It might say, do something stupid, like, you know, check the tension of the screws every 500 hours. Well, if the mechanic doesn't do that, this airplane, you know, doesn't meet up to the airworthiness certificate that's in the airplane. So that could present a problem with insurance coverage in the future if the plane crashes. Just like an AD. Yeah. I like to see a complete AD list all signed off in 5 or 10 pages. A signature through everything is a mechanic's number. I don't want to see a blank form with no signatures, because then I got to go through AD research in the logbook. And that's a big job. And if they miss one AD, and tell you the truth, usually these older airplanes that are 40, 50 years old, I usually find an AD on the engine, and that everybody didn't know about because the service they use. They didn't get all the serial numbers of all the components of the engine. And then when the engine's overhauled, you know, we have the manufacturers recommend, you know, you have all the tags at the overhaul, because sometimes there's an AD on the crankshaft itself and the piston pins and all kinds of bad stuff there. So unfortunately, half the airplanes I do, more than half, probably 80%, I find an outstanding AD. It makes the airplane unairworthy its whole life.
It's actually pretty amazing how many of these ADs can be overlooked. And it's really only legal in the logbook when each AD is individually signed off, right? We can't just have a list with that says all ADs complied with or all applicable ADs complied with. I mean, they need to list out each individual AD and at least have a signature at the bottom of that list.
Yeah, there's an advisory circular out, which is an interpretation of law. And FAA says you do not say all ADs are complied with. Well, for a legal point, you know, maybe you got something there, because this guy said it was all done. So it's up to the it's up to the judge when he's judging whether or not the owner or the operator is responsible for the airplane. So that's an important factor. But if the whole sheet is signed off and it's got his AMP number and his name, that means it was done. Even if he draws a line through, but I don't want to see blank pages. But if they're not signed off, they're not done. And you inherit all the liabilities that come with an airplane. Once you buy it, you get all the paperwork. And if an AD isn't signed off, it's entirely your fault. What we find is airplanes that have been, annuals have been done in accordance with Part 43, Appendix D of the FARs, we find a lot of defects because that is a minimum manual inspection. Now, being that it's signed off correctly, I'm not going to recheck all those things. But, you know, what I'm looking for is ones that aren't signed off. And I find a lot of them.
Yeah, and the thing about the documentation being correct is that, like you said, Don, if it's not signed off properly, then it wasn't done. And the question becomes, well, if the documentation and the attention to detail to the documentation wasn't there, then that, to me, makes the rest of the maintenance of the airplane, at least recently, questionable for that time period. And a side note also is that I would put more value, dollar value, on an airplane that's been maintained in accordance with the manufacturer's recommendations over that same airplane that was maintained, particularly with an annual inspection, to FAR 43 Appendix D. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I do. The manufacturer's inspection, a lot of times, well, all the time, has intervals. Every 100 hours, every 200 hours, every 500 hours, every 1,000 hours, it's many pages long. And by any time you get done with the manufacturer's inspection, if you said you did that, you have to do, well, when was the last time a 500 hour was done? It's due now, so I got to do it. And so if you do all those inspections, we wind up with less defects on the airplane during the virtual pre-buy inspections or whatever kind you get, simply because, you know, it's been a thorough inspection. But that's a more expensive inspection. You know, that's usually a $20,000 annual. But you could tell it. It doesn't matter how old the airplane is. I've seen 50-year-old airplanes, and, man, they were in great shape because they spent the money doing those inspections. But a Part 43 Appendix D inspection, man, you know, people do say, hey, where's the best place to go to an annual? Well, he did an annual, and it only cost like $1,200. So they're going to flock to this guy with Part 43, and it's going to be an expensive inspection following that one.
Yeah, and another point too, when it comes to documentation, whether it's the logbooks or the FAA records or 337 forms or whatever the case is, it's quite interesting that there could be such a differential or a variation in wording, and the wording is so important, right? When we see something that says this airplane has been inspected in accordance with annual inspection, or that the engine was overhauled, I mean, those words have different meanings. And so maybe for a second, Don, can we just briefly discuss kind of the differences in overhaul terminology? You know, because that right there places a different value to the airplane depending on the extent and type of overhaul that was done, as well as if there are supporting documentation outside the logbook, i.e. like a work order or an invoice or some sort of maintenance release, in addition to the sign-off. Can we just talk about that for a second?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of recent examples. Actually, just a few days ago. We've got a beach Sierra here, and it only has 40 hours since the overhaul. What does that mean? Well, it did have a factory-manufactured engine. Wow, that was good. You know, because if it's a factory-manufactured engine, you can throw away all the old logbooks. And man, it's a fresh engine. It starts, so there's, you know, obviously all the ADs and everything have been complied with because only a couple of people are allowed to do a remanufactured engine. And that's the manufacturer themselves or a place like Western Skyways out in Grand Junction, Colorado. So it sounds real good, but what happened? That was 5 years ago, and the airplane only flew 40 hours in 5 years. Wow. So what came up in the last 5 years? You know, do we have corrosion in the cylinders? And that's why the manufacturer recommends doing a borescope. Well, not just any borescope. They come out with a new one. And the new borescope, the head of it is an adjustable light, and it turns around 180 degrees. So they recommend that every time the spark plugs come out, that you do a borescope inspection. And so do we, because a lot of bad things could happen if you have a bad exhaust valve and the valve guides are worn.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, going back to what you were saying there with the factory remanufactured engine, like you said, Don, it's not just the engine operating time since overhaul, or, you know, what we would call time since overhaul. It's also the calendar time The airplane has 40 hours on the engine, that's great, but if 5 years goes by, you might have an engine that's in just as bad a condition as an engine with 1,000 hours or 2,000 hours on it or something like that. And I just wanted to point out to everyone that there is an advisory circular, if you guys are interested, that goes over reciprocating engine overhaul terminology and standards, because the differences in overhaul type really comes down to who did it and what the standards of the overhaul were. So anyway, you guys can check out Advisory Circular 43-11, and that goes into that in a little bit more detail. But these are things that not only affect the potential safety of the airplane, but it certainly affects the value of the airplane. And obviously that is probably one of your top concerns in addition to safety is value, because you don't want to be paying for an airplane for assumptions that you have made about the status of the airplane's maintenance, and you don't want to be overpaying for something that isn't worth what the claim may be from the seller, or some sort of misinterpretation of what was actually done.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, there's another thing involved here. A lot of these pilot errors was originally induced by mechanical failure. So, you know, that's what we want to head off to pass, those mechanical failures. You got to think out of the box to do that.
Yeah, and touching on that real quick, Don, something that might be kind of out of your mind when you're buying an airplane is the type of emergency equipment that is on board that particular airplane that you're looking at, because there is a real possibility that you'll have to put the airplane down somewhere off airport. So it's kind of important to really think about what equipment is in the airplane now and what you may plan on putting in the airplane later. For example, the ELT is a big one. The 406 megahertz ELT versus a 121.5, a lot of our listeners may not know the difference. And that's a selling point also with an airplane, and also perhaps a value, dollar value point when looking at an airplane to buy. So can you just real quick discuss the advantages and differences between the 406 megahertz ELT, which is the new style, versus the more the old style 121.5. What's going on with that makes that different?
Well, you're allowed to still fly with the 121.5, but you better crash at an airport, they're not going to find you, because it's not monitored by the satellites anymore. And the airlines are supposed to monitor it, and some of them do, but they're going to have a hard time finding it, because it's not a pinpoint location. They don't have a clue where you are. They got to do all these homing devices and try to find you somehow. And they don't find most of the people. So now a 406 ELT communicates directly with the satellites. I'll give you an example. I talked to a guy, he was in his hangar, and he just turned it on to test it. He thought it was good to test it. And he wasn't looking at the manufacturer's instructions on how to test it and when to test it. And within a few minutes, he got a phone call and said, "Have you crashed or are you okay?" They found them right away, that quick, because they have all your information. And they get, I believe the number is a few thousand calls every day from 406 transponders where people didn't test it according to the manufacturer's instructions. And they just figured, well, I'm allowed to test it 5 minutes past the hour. But that's not always the case. So, boy, that's a lifesaver, 406, especially if you're floating in the Caribbean with sharks around you.
Yeah, and I think one of the other podcasts, I think it was the Finer Points podcast, had a representative on that was being interviewed about improper test procedures for ELTs, and they basically have to sort through and sift through all these various signals that they're getting to figure out which is a legit one and which is an inadvertent one and what have you. So, you know, obviously a side note point here is that you should always test your ELT in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions and not maybe some old word of mouth, you know, tribal knowledge, as they call it, you know, that you might be used to, because things have changed since then. Also, going back to the 121.5 ELT, I was at a recent FAA safety meeting, and they had the fire chief from one of the local fire departments tell us a story of an airplane that was flying from Orlando out to Titusville, Florida, which is only about 20 miles away. And he got himself in a situation where he's flying in heavy IMC, and long story short, he ended up crashing. And it took the fire department about 2 hours before they were even able to somewhat pinpoint a signal, you know, because he had the old 121.5 transponder. So anyway, it is a point definitely worth making when you're considering an airplane. You know, if you're getting an airplane that's already got a 406 a 406 ELT in the airplane already, or what the cost would be to upgrade it. You know, it's something definitely to think about as you're moving forward in your pursuit for an airplane.
Let's talk about instrument panel placards. What? Well, you know, many years ago, before they updated the POA's pilot handbook, they came out with placarded airplanes. What is that all about? Yeah, basically all you had was a little manufacturer's book, like the kind you buy in the pilot shop. And in that book, it said that these placards have to be on the airplane. So they like have a placard all over the airplane telling you how to fly it. So you don't have a POH, a pilot handbook. And if you do have a pilot handbook, you know, you're not legal to fly with inoperative equipment unless it's approved by the FAA for every make and model. So like your number two comm isn't working, and you say, well, okay, that could be deferred to the next inspection unless you're flying IFR. And so they might approve that. And then you got a placard at inoperative, and you got to make a logbook entry. And so the next guy knows who might fly the airplane if it's not you. And the very next inspection, it can't stay inoperative. The mechanic has to make it operative again. So people don't realize that they're flying around with inoperative equipment, and the airplane might not be airworthy according to the type certificate of the airplane.
Yeah, that's right. Not just that, but also whatever minimum equipment is required under Part 91207 that dictates the various equipment. But also, like you said, Don, placarded airplanes. So airplanes prior to 1979, I believe, were considered placarded airplanes because all they had was like an owner's manual versus a POH or an approved airplane flying manual, AFM. So, and even airplanes since then have required placards, and that would be in the POH or AFM, which would tell you what placards are still required to be on the instrument panel. And of course, depending on how the airplane was certified, there are placards required for the various pieces of the external part of the airplane. These are just common things that we see wrong, and it's simple. And when people think of an airworthiness squawk, they often think that something's mechanically wrong with the airplane, which, you know, that does occur. But most of the time, it's a documentation issue or some sort of technicality with a regulation issue. And as you mentioned, Don, you become liable and you inherit all the problems, including those seemingly minute issues that come up. But at the end of the day, they would cost you money as an airplane owner to resolve or rectify in some way.
And also, we have another thing called fuel leaks. Well, you know, if you look at the top of the wing of an airplane and it's not placarded correctly, and all of a sudden you see a little stain, like a red stain around one of the attaching screws that hold down that fuel access cover. Well, there's a good chance that the dome nut underneath has been damaged by a screw that's too large, and it might have made a puncture in it. And that's part of the fuel cell, the rubber fuel cell, in a lot of airplanes. So what happens is you take that screw out, you might have a serious fuel leak. You might have to take that rubber bladder out and fix it, and either repair it or replace it. So that's another thing to look for. Does it have the right placards on the wing? Because the plane's not airworthy if it doesn't. And is it seeping any fuel out of the dome nuts because of the wrong size screws? And it's a rat race out there. You know, we knew last fall that the Cessna 182 airplanes have appreciated overnight $20,000. I mean, you could have bought a nice one for, you know, about $30,000. And now the same airplane is $50,000. And why? Because of basic med. We had like 40,000 people who got their basic med done in the new way you do it, going to your family physician. And now they are legal to fly and fly at night, IFR and everything. And above, up to, they're legal to do it up to 18,000 feet, not faster than 250 knots, which is a personal limitation, not an airplane limitation. They don't need to do this. They all ran out and they bought airplanes. And it just came out last week in an article that the Skyhawk has appreciated $20,000. And we knew it last fall. And so if you don't get with the program and, you know, do your homework the same day and the next morning, call up that owner and say, hey, I think I want to buy the airplane, so I'm going to put an escrow account in there just in case. Then he knows you're a serious buyer and he's going to start fixing defects for you. And but you don't want to lay too many on them at the first call.
Well, yeah, and one of the advantages of pulling FAA records, for example, as a starting point for you, whether you have a professional do it or you try and do it on your own or whatever the case is you learn a lot about the airplane immediately without even having to notify the seller that you're interested. So you can make a go, no-go decision on the airplane just from the FAA files. And then you'll also have a very good history of the airplane and where it's who it's been owned by and where it's lived and all that, but also what's been done to it over the years in terms of modifications and alterations and repairs. And it gives you a good place to start. And it also helps you formulate a lot of questions that you can clarify with the owner as well quickly. Like Don said, the market is moving quickly. It's definitely very fast-paced, and good airplanes sell quickly. So it's important to be timely in all your inquiries for airplanes that you're serious about.
Let's talk about hail damage. What is hail damage and what's the effect of it? Well, nobody likes hail damage, but it's kind of hard to see. You really got to get the airplane in a hangar with the sun shining in the hangar. So I did a 182 just a few weeks ago. And at first I didn't notice it because it was out in the bright sun. I said, push the airplane in the hangar, please, and pick up that elevator. And my goodness, the hail damage was inches apart. The whole elevators on the top had hail damage. And I looked at the Cessna specs, and you would have to reskin those elevators. And because I don't believe you could just buy new ones, it'd be very expensive. So they had to send it away to Airframe Structures, I believe they're in Ohio. And that wasn't cheap. And according to Cessna's own document, these elevators were unairworthy. Yes, it had hail damage on the ailerons, but it wasn't as bad. Even had a few spots of hail damage on the fuselage, on the top of the fuselage. And that's kind of uncommon because the fuselage skin is thicker than the elevator skins. So anyway, so what does it cost? Well, it cost $10,000. Then they sent it back with a primer coat. And if the airplane is white, your mechanic out there in the field isn't going to match that white color. If it's black, it's not a problem. So I always recommend, you know, having an automotive paint shop come out and give you a custom formula. Better yet, let them even paint it, you know, and then the mechanic will have the matching white color. Otherwise, you could tell that the shade is different. White, you can really, it's difficult to match, and it makes the plane unairworthy in this case. So that's important to check for hail damage. And the only good way to do it is to have it in the hangar with the sun shining in and pick. Then you're looking for hangar rash too. You know, that's dents in the trailing edge. That could sacrifice the skin and make you have to replace it.
Sure. So I was also going to just mention too, you know, if you see an airplane that is in need of a paint job, let's say, and you don't maybe, you know, you're okay with the way the paint looks and you don't plan on painting it for a little while. It's not really a priority for you. But you have to think, too, that if there's large areas on the fuselage, especially you see it a lot like on the underside of the fuselage where there's primer showing or bare metal or something like that. And, you know, you can pick up a little paint touch-up kit. But like you said, Don, matching that white is so difficult because there's so many different shades of white. But also you have to think about the wear that's on the original, whatever that original color white was. And so it'll be very obvious that there has been some touch up and it won't look that pretty. So when you're really considering, you know, correcting things like large areas of chip paint or any areas of corrosion or, like you said, hail damage, I mean, there's more that goes into it than just, you know, what's the quickest or easiest way to get it fixed? You know, there's some other thoughts to consider also.
So basically, you got to get on your back and go under the belly of the airplane. And usually the belly of the airplane is dirty because, you know, the washers don't usually get down there. They don't want to get on their back. And you could tell a lot about the belly of the airplane. It was all got streaked with oil, maybe even hydraulic fluid. And that might be leaky master cylinders and the brakes. And so what you got to do, but it was an unpressurized airplane, there's drain holes in the belly of the airplane, and you got to get, you know, your maybe a ballpoint pen refill. You take that out and you see if those drain holes are open. Because if they're not open, guess what? When you land from condensation, the water is staying there. And it could be staying up against stringers and formers. Let's say it's up against a former, and the former is corroded, and it doesn't meet the minimum specifications, which is usually 10% of the thickness. If it's corroded beyond that, you got to replace this. And how do you replace a former? You break the airplane in two pieces and replace the whole former. Either that or you put a patch on it, but you still got to take the airplane apart in two pieces to do that. So it could get really expensive. So what you should do is, if you have a borescope, like the kind we recommend with this swivel on it and an adjustable light, what's important to you is to make sure those drain holes are open. Otherwise, you're going to have to get into a little more checking of this airplane to make sure you don't have corrosion, because it could be a big deal.
Yeah, that's a great point, Don. And I'll put a link in the show notes to the borescope that we use and recommend. I think it's fairly reasonable. And it's been proven. We've been using it for I guess, about a year and a half, and it works real nice. But anyway, I wanted to ask you, Don, you know, there are a lot of issues with certain airplanes with there being corrosion, potential corrosion or fatiguing in the wing spar. And maybe you can elaborate a little bit more about how you can only see one side of the spar unless you take the tanks out. So maybe we can talk about that for a second.
Yeah. On all the PA-28 series, and maybe you heard about the crash in Embry-Riddle, the wing failed because of the F-spar carry-through. And that was unbelievable. And the last I heard, it's been kept pretty quiet. You know, there's 100,000 airline pilots training out there, and we need 300,000 airline pilots. And guess what is the most popular trainer? Yeah, you guessed it. It's the PA-28-201 retractable gear. They inspected, I believe, 8 other airplanes in Embry-Riddle, and all they admitted is one airplane had the same problem. They had a crack in the crossover where the rear spar attaches to the wing fitting. So here's what they do. There's an advisory circular out. Actually, there's a proposed AD out for almost a year now, and they haven't made it an AD because they're afraid of a corroded spar, not only the PA-28s, but also a lot of the PA-32s, even some of the newer Saratogas. It depends on the serial number of the airplane. So they want you to take the whole leading edge of the wing off, and that is the fuel tank. And when you take that off, it has special screws that hold it on, structural screws. You don't just put it on with any of those screws. But as soon as you take that off, the first thing, two things I want you to do is replace the vent line and the fuel line, because it might have been on here for 20 years, and it might be just seeping, you know, a little fuel out of it, and that would enhance the corrosion of the spar. So what do you do if you have a corroded spar? Well, I don't think you're going to find another one. Last year, I heard somebody found not a spar, but a whole wing. Because the spar, you can't unrivet all the skin on the ring to replace the scar. That's not possible. So you're going to have a salvaged airplane. And maybe you could sell the other wing if it's good. But otherwise, you're talking salvage value here. So what do you do? There's a service bulletin, which isn't required, and they give you the procedures and how to do this. And if you find an airplane that had that already done, even though, you know, you're supposed to do it every so many years, I think it's 5 or 7 years, even if it was done 10 years ago, at least it was done. And that's a valuable airplane. So now how are we going to check about elongated holes in the attaching fitting, where the rear, the wing attaches to the crossover spar, which caused this accident, Embry-Riddle? How are we going to check that? Well, that's anybody's guess. But, you know, you got to shake hands with the wings. And I would recommend pushing the wings left and right. And if there's any movement, even a 16th of an inch, you could figure out that attaching hole is elongated You're either that or the bolster's worn, and it's vibrating in flight, and it might crack that carry-through spar at the rear, which caused the accident. And you found in another airplane, too, at Embry-Riddle. So I wish we'd get an update on that. We could find out what's going on. That could be a serious problem. Now, the new AD, the proposed AD that's been around for so long, now they got you cutting inspection plate holes in the underside of the wing of these airplanes to look at the rear of the spar. So that's going to be a task, and it's a proposed AD for a long time now. I don't know why it hasn't come out yet. This airplane that crashed had 13,000 landing cycles. Could you imagine? It only had 7,000 hours, but 13,000 landing cycles. And so I'm sure that attributed to the cause of this accident.
I remember also, Don, that there was an investigation quite a few years ago on an Archer that had the same, almost identical problem where the wing failed. Because of the same issues with fatiguing. Now, I wanted to mention the service. There's a few service bulletins actually that address some of these issues with the spar and with the wing attach fittings, and I'll include the links to those service bulletins in the show notes for reference. You know, like you said, also it affects the 28 series, the PA-28, as well as the 32 in most cases. And that's because the wing structure is shared among both types of airplanes. So if you're looking at like a Matrix or a Malibu or something like that, the PA-46 series airplanes, it's a totally different wing structure. So anyway, something to think about too when deciding on an airplane. Don, did you have anything else you wanted to mention today?
I would like to mention about cheap jet airplanes.
Yeah.
You know, there's recently airplanes came on the market a Cessna Citation that only requires one pilot to fly it, and it's only $225,000. And it's really a good buy for that price, if it has some engine time left. But you know, the engine overhauls cost, just one engine is double the value of the airplane. So now you got two engines. So what do you do once the engines reach their life limit? And in a lot of cases, jet engines have life limited parts in it. So, and it's under the inspection program that you overhaul them at the recommended manufacturer's overhaul time, because it's in the inspection program. So you got an airplane that's worthless all of a sudden. But then again, it might be a good airplane to fly for 900 hours, because you're going so fast that 900 hours might take you 10 years to fly it off. So you might have a neat airplane. But of course, you got to be careful in who's doing the maintenance, because, you know, it could cost you a fortune. They have all these required inspections. So you got to get a guy that'll do it in that small shop on the outside that, you know, might not, you know, squawk a lot of things at a big center would do, because you could lose the airplane, and if you bring it to a really big shop, it could be more to do the inspections than the airplane's worth. And so that's another factor. But I've had that actually as a Citation Ultra, a 560, and a famous person owned the airplane, and he was selling it because his pilot was my age and he was retiring. He don't fly anymore. And that pilot had a blank check to go to every maintenance shop. You know, he went to all the big centers to get that plane maintained. And we didn't find too many squawks with that airplane, except we found a service bulletin that wasn't complied with. And that meant his altitude when he was at above the flight levels where you have to have 1,000 foot separation. He didn't know how close he was to those other airplanes. So that was a bad situation for 9 years. Of course, it was fixed, and it only cost $15,000 to fix it, and the seller paid for everything, and even the pilot's ferry flight out to get it fixed, and the pilot's salary, his fuel, paid for everything. So we were happy campers, and we're glad we got it fixed, because not too long ago, less than a year ago, Bombardier 605, which is a big airplane, and it was flying under an Airbus 380, you know, that's a big airplane and huge wake turbulence. And for some reason, they were less than 1,000 feet apart, and it flipped that Bombardier upside down and severely damaged the wings and fuselage. And he fortunately made it back to a landing to the closest airport. And he was over the ocean at the time. and the plane was salvage value. It was just bent out of shape, the whole airplane. And that is a big, you know, that's a strong airplane, the Bombardier. So just to wake turbulence from being too close. So they got to figure this one out, you know. If these altimeters were off just a few hundred feet, this could happen.
Yeah, and that's why the RVSM certification and testing and maintenance of those systems is so important. And I wanted to just back up for a second and give you guys a tip on if you're looking at any jet airplane, but especially an older one, it's really important to have a good look at the exhaust section of the airplane, because something that's a lot of these somewhat older airplanes are susceptible to is pitting corrosion in the exhaust, and that can get very expensive because you're only allowed so much material that you can remove from the exhaust section, the metals in the exhaust, and if you don't catch that on the pre-buy or early on, that can be very, very, very expensive, because often you'd have to replace the whole exhaust section itself if it's beyond the limit.
So these are all things to think about. You know, the modern airplane is the Cessna Citation CJ series, and they hold their value pretty good. Matter of fact, you did an interview with Ken Wolf. Maybe you should tell him a little bit about that and what happened.
Yeah, so Ken Wolf, for those of you that may not have seen the interview, he purchased a early model Citation jet, CJ, just a straight CJ, the 525. And there has been several variations and upgrades made to that particular airframe over the years, because that airframe has been around about over 20 years now. But anyway, he purchased this older airplane, and it worked real well for him. And eventually, he got to the point where he was looking for a little bit more performance and a little bit more efficiency. So he upgraded to the next model up CJ, which is the CJ 2 Plus, which is a 525A designation, and that airplane has a FADEC controlled engine, so the full authority digital engine controller. So all the engine parameters and speeds and fuel burn is heavily monitored by a computer and maximized for efficiency. But anyways, those airplanes are very popular and they hold their value well, and those are equipped with the Williams FJ44 engines, which were a real game changer for light jets in general. You know, a massive improvement over the earlier 500 series Citations that had the Pratt & Whitney engines on them. And the maintenance support for the Williams engines, whether it's the older engines or a newer one, is typically much better and more responsive than you would find on the older 500 series Citations with the Pratt & Whitney engines.
Yeah. And I got something to add to that. You know, the industry says there's the best maintenance support. The Williams engine people, those are actually Rolls-Royce engines in a way. And not only that, but you didn't tell them about what Ken did to that original CJ. He put the kit on there with winglets. And tell them about that, Adam.
Yeah, he did. And he took very good care of his airplane and also made sure that he was keeping up with modifications to make for the airplane. And one of the modifications he made was the addition of the Tamarack winglets, which is actually a really cool mod. And I've seen them in the field a lot. And I know the various Citation service centers around the country are doing a lot more of those mods on the CJ series and other models of the airplanes. But anyway, what makes the mod unique is that not only does it improve your overall efficiency of the airplane and climb performance and cruise performance, but it's a relatively inexpensive modification compared to more traditional winglet installations, because this particular mod doesn't require any additional wing structure to be put onto the wings. So it's a patented system. It's kind of hard to explain, but basically it has like little flaperons that are on the outboard section of the wing that absorb any extra load that might be put on the wingtips as a result of the winglets. And they flap around up and down kind of like mini ailerons, I guess, automatically and electrically. To unload the wings. And it's interesting because anytime you turn the battery switch on when the airplane's on the ground, the winglets come to life. I think they call them TAMs, these parts that actually move. And they come to life and they can catch you off guard if you're not prepared for that. But anyway, it's a really cool modification. I think he said he spent somewhere in the $200,000 range for that particular modification. But what that did, though, is make the airplane more marketable in a relatively competitive market. You know, light jet sales is pretty competitive. And so whatever modifications you can make to make the airplane stand out, but as well as perform better, that's going to be helpful. So it turned out to be a good investment for him overall, because like you said, Don, he was able to sell his airplane very quickly and at a price that he was happy with. And so he was able to move up to that next step airplane. And really, that's the goal of most of the airplane owners out there, I think, is eventually to continue moving up the ladder. Maybe not necessarily to a jet, but you know, they start out with a lower performing airplane and move their way up typically. And Ken is a great example of someone that does that, because he's owned many airplanes through the years. Right, Don?
Yes, he did. Hey, let me talk about another thing while we're getting into that. And that's the twin-engine airplane. We haven't talked about that. Well, if you're over open water, it's nice to have two engines. I think everybody will agree. So why is a twin-engine airplane so cheap? You know, you could buy, you know, a Seneca or, you know, for $65,000. Why is it so cheap? Well, you got two engines to take care of, and the maintenance and the annuals and a lot more expensive on a twin engine airplane. So you're going to sink a lot of money into it on an annual basis. Plus you're using more fuel. You're at least two, if not three times more in expenses owning that airplane. So that's why they're so cheap. But it's cheap insurance if you're flying over open bodies of water, because now if an engine fails, you can continue to the nearest airport.
Yeah, and you know, not only that factor, Don, but you know, if you can realistically afford that twin engine airplane, and by afford I mean the operating costs and the maintenance costs that are associated with it, it is a good investment, because the market for twin engine airplanes is very different than the market for single engine piston airplanes, and the market moves a little slower. And the airplanes are a little cheaper, and it's definitely less competitive in terms of number of buyers, you know, so the buyer demand is less competitive. So it's a good market to be in if you can afford it. But that's, again, and that's why we do these interviews with different types of airplane owners, is to give you their perspectives, because the best place to get the information in terms of what things cost and what you can expect with a purchase like that is to hear it from the horse's mouth, as they say, you know, the people that are flying these airplanes regularly. So, and that's another thing that we like to talk about too, is that, you know, it's important not to get more airplane than you can afford. You know, sometimes it's not just what you need, it's also what you can afford, because a twin engine airplane, it's great insurance, like you said, Don, flying over water, but if you're not prepared and able to handle some of the additional expenses, I mean, it could literally be a financial disaster for you, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it all depends. You know, we got to find those defects that they don't find during an annual inspection. And, you know, we got two engines to worry about here. We got two propellers, and we got all those things that can go wrong. So, you know, basically, it depends on your mission. So we need to talk about your mission. And what about the payload? Yeah, I mean, you know, if you want to put four or five people in there and fly for 3 or 4 hours, and you only have a useful load of 1,000 pounds, you're going to leave some people behind, or you're going to just fly 2 hours and land and get fuel and fly again for another 2 hours. So I recommend that you get the current weight and balance before you even consider the airplane. Tell them to take a picture of that current weight and balance and email it to you. Because if you want a full load, and if you want to fly 3 or 4 hours, you're probably you'll need an airplane with more horsepower, probably turbocharged, because a lot of times these turbocharged airplanes increase the useful load, sometimes by as much as 200 pounds, and that'll complete your mission without stopping for fuel. Because it's expensive to stop the fuel. You know, you lose all that time landing and fueling up and getting back to altitude where the airplane flies efficiently. And then we have the headwind factor. And so we got a lot of things to do here to figure out before you even look at the airplane and get that information.
Yeah, and on that note, Don, we recently were working with a couple that were looking at purchasing a Piper Saratoga, which is a great airplane, but it turned out, as the more we learned about them and what their needs were, specifically in terms of useful load, that that airplane wasn't going to cut it. Like you said, they're going to have to leave some people and baggage behind. And this isn't always the case. Usually we talk people down in airplane, but it was definitely became apparent to them that they were probably needing to step up. And then they began pursuing the Piper Matrix, which is a bigger airplane, much more useful load, a little better performer. And so anyway.
Well, actually, I'm going to get off the subject a little bit and talk about ADS-B in and out. Okay, most pilots want that in and out because they want to go up above 18,000 feet with this plane. And of course, internationally flying, you have to, if you just have to minimum, you know, stick on the window, look at the iPad, you need ADS-B out for sure. But in is kind of a lifesaver. It shows you the airplanes underneath you that just have mostly transponders that don't have ADS-B at all. And that's probably pretty important. So what Garmin does is they'll hook up this whole thing for you, and with a special antenna and everything. But the box, the box that makes this all possible is in the back of the airplane. Now, these old Bonanzas, the V-tail Bonanzas, basically, they're an airplane that could be out of the FCG limits very easily. And in some of these older retail Bonanzas, in order to be within the FCG limits, the passengers have to hold the luggage in their laps in the seat behind you. Isn't that? Now, you go ahead and put this other object back there, and that makes it even worse. So those are things to consider. And one other point, there's some Garmin 1000 units that came out of the factory that was installed under the original type data sheets, the original FAA blueprints. And in those kind of units, you're not allowed to take those units out. And there was people out there spending $40,000 to get a modern panel, and they couldn't do the vertical profile descents. If you're around a big airport and you don't have all this equipment, they're going to vector you all over the place to get around these big airports. And there's a few dozen in the country now, and the airlines have the right to make a vertical profile right down to landing, and they own all that airspace, and they're not going to fly you in their airspace. They're going to say, divert you 30 to 40 miles out of the way to get around that. So that could be expensive if you live in a satellite airport right outside of an airline stop. And so that's something to think about too. This poor fellow spent all that money and he still couldn't qualify for the rules for a vertical profile descents right down to the runway. So they couldn't reserve airspace for him. They had to vect him around these big airports.
Yes, definitely a lot of things to think about. So with that, guys, we're going to wrap it up here and let you digest everything that we just mentioned. And we appreciate you being here with us. And Don, did you have any closing words before we go?
Yes. When Adam is a great interviewer. And when he interviews people, he's trying to get it straight from the owner. All the expenses and everything went right, everything that went wrong. So Adam has some great interviews with, one of them had, 220,000 hits on YouTube? Wow. 310Q model. But anyway, we don't research those airplanes ahead of time because there's so many factors involved. And a lot of my tips are airplanes I did a year or two ago, and things have changed in that. So if we're going to check out an airplane, then we research it. But with Adam doing an interview, we're kind of just leaving the owner tell us all about the airplane. And that's what people like. They want to know right from the horse's mouth what it cost to operate that airplane, what was good, what was bad, how he went about it. And that reminds me of that Glass Air we just did. And, you know, the interview you did, it was an excellent bit to interview. It was really worth watching. But different FISDO offices have different regulations, and we got to get into all that stuff if we're going to actually do some kind of a virtual pre-buy or a regular pre-buy in this airplane. We got to advise you. So anyway, the information sometimes I say has been outmoded because it was a year or two ago and regulations change. And a lot of it's up to the local FISDO offices in different areas of the country. That's a flight standard district office because they're kind of the rule makers in their area.
Yes, they are. Definitely. So thanks, guys, again for being here. We really appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you again next time. And if you have any questions or you'd like to contribute to the conversation, feel free to send us an email to feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com. And of course, check out the show notes where we're going to put some extra links to some of the topics that we covered today. And you can see that at airplaneintelpodcast.com. Well, guys, thanks again. Keep the greasy side down and stay safe. We'll see you later.
Yes. Have a good day, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Airplane Intel Podcast. If you like what you just heard, we hope that you'll subscribe to the show and follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter by searching Pre-Buy Guys. To access show notes, archives, and other free resources, head on over to airplaneintelpodcast.com. To get answers to your questions, drop us a line on social media or send an email to feedback@airplaneintelpodcast.com. You can also reach us by phone at 904-290-3870. And remember, owning an airplane doesn't have to be hazardous to your wealth.